is Your Money. I am Susie Jones, and we are so happy to have you with us on this beautiful Sunday morning. Hope your morning is going well. We have, again, as usual, as always, happy to have Bruce Elmer today, the founder of Wealth Enhancement and financial advisor. Bruce, hello. Is Peg gone off fishing?
I think Peg is probably on a golf junket today. I can't remember where she was going, but I think it was golf with some girlfriends.
Oh,
so Peg's getting a day off.
Nice.
But hey, Susie, today's topic, it's interesting. We call it common sense investing, the wealth enhancement way. And we're going to actually talk about investing. And a lot of people might be listening going, well, duh, it's a financial talk show. But if you listen to our show and you listen to the messaging at Wealth Enhancement, so often our messaging is not about investing. And part of the reason is because that's what everybody in our space talks about. Their investments are better than their competition's investments. And the consuming public wants to know, should they get into the stock market? Should they get out of the stock market? Should they buy funds? Should they buy individual stocks? Is this a company A a better investment company than company B? And it's what the whole world talks about. We try to talk about comprehensive planning, strategies, having a plan, understanding your core values to make goals and decisions, and then your strategies will hopefully, you have a roadmap to try to get you where you want to go. But it occurred to me, we spend so much time not talking about investing that maybe it's time we actually take a day, take a show where we do talk about investing. And very specifically, we're going to talk about what we call some common sense things that everybody should do, whether you're a client of Wealth Enhancement, whether you're with another advisory firm, whether you're trying to do it on your own. I think the principles and the things I'm going to talk about today actually make sense for everyone. No matter where you're at in your journey, whether you're in your 20s or 30s and just getting started, or in your 50s and 60s and near the home stretch towards retirement, I think the things we're going to talk about are going to be universally true. So again, common sense, discipline, having a plan, these things are key, but it starts, again, with core values. How can I advise somebody if I don't know what's important to them, if I don't know what their goals and objectives are, if I don't know what they're trying to accomplish? Smart investing isn't about looking at the headlines and picking the right investment, and I'm going to emphasize that a lot today. Smart investing is really about trying to know where you want to get. And the starting point for me, Susie and listeners, I think if you ask a lot of people and say, what's your goal of your investments? What's your investment strategy? Their first thought would be, well, I want to get the highest return I can. But is that really the right answer? To get a high return might mean that you have to take more risk than you're willing to take, than you're comfortable taking. Our goal for our clients, when we talk about investing and doing it common sense, the wealth enhancement way, our goal is to get a return on investment that will achieve your goals and objectives. What does that mean? Retire when you want to, with the lifestyle you want, to be able to get that return and to be able to get it with the least amount of risk possible. I'm not a believer in having people take unnecessary risk to try to get higher returns that they don't need anyway to be successful and to get them where they want to be. On the other hand, and we've talked about this on the show a lot before also, some people get too conservative too soon. They hit 60 or they retire and they say, oh my gosh, I'm afraid of a market retraction now, I better get out of the market. But if you don't get enough return and you live too long, you might blow through all of your money before you die. So finding that balance of taking the risk that you need to take to get the return that you want to be happy and live the way you want, is what we mean when we talk about common sense investing or investing, the wealth enhancement way. So a couple things that I think are universally applicable to everybody, and a lot of people aren't doing these things. The first one is putting money and having an emergency fund or a rainy day account, if you will. I don't remember the exact statistic, but I know it's a majority. It's over 50% of Americans. I've seen surveys recently where the question is basically, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, if you had a financial issue come up, you had to have an auto repair or a home repair, and you had $1,000 cost to get this thing done, this emergency that you have to do, over half Americans surveyed said they don't have $1,000. They'd have to put it on a credit card, and then when the invoice comes, they might not have the money to pay the balance. Now they're paying interest on something, an essential thing that they needed for their life, because they didn't have a rainy day fund or an emergency fund. So, Susie, over the years, I've lost count of the number of times that somebody has said to me, I would like to invest with Wealth Enhancement. I want to invest. I want to be a client. And I've actually talked them out of investing with me and said, look, until you have a rainy day fund, money in the bank with no risk of principal, that's liquid and safe and there when you need it, you shouldn't be investing in the market or more sophisticated investments until you've covered that rainy day or emergency fund. And again, most people haven't done this. Now, in a similar but slightly different, I've also talked people out of investing with me before if they've had inefficient debt. So they've got, you know, a double-digit interest rate and a high balance on a credit card, and they come to me and say, I want to invest. I might say, your best investment right now, is to pay off that high interest debt. If you're paying interest at, you know, 10, 12, 15, 16%, I don't think we can get you that rate of return on investment. So paying down debt that's that high of an interest rate is actually a much better investment than trying to put money in the market and beat the cost of the debt service. So,
Bruce?
Yes.
Question.
Yes, please.
Is it wise to use your investment money to pay down your debt?
That's a great question. Thank you. And I love it when you do that, by the way, because I get off on a tangent and get enthralled with the sound of my own voice, and I like this to be conversational. It might be, Susie. So, again, I always tell people it's never a bad idea to take winnings off the table or to lock in gains. And especially if you're doing that for a good reason, like paying down inefficient debt. So in theory, my answer is yes. But again, as is always the case, the devil's in the details. So where are you taking the money from, and what debt are you paying off? Let me give you an example where it doesn't make sense. So if your money is in a tax-deferred account like a 401k or an IRA, and you're thinking, I've got this onerous debt that I want to pay off, I'm going to take it out of my IRA. Well, that's a fully taxable withdrawal. The IRA was the money was put in there with pre-tax dollars, or give you a deduction for the contribution. You've been deferring the taxes or not getting any 1099s as it grows. Now you're pulling money out and you're going to pay the taxes. So the cost of using that money, you don't just have an opportunity cost of the lost rate of return that you've been making, but you also have to pay the tax. And it might actually be more onerous than the cost of the debt service. On the other hand, if you've got a non-qualified type of an account and the taxes are negligible, or it might be long-term capital gains rates instead of ordinary income tax rates, that might make all the sense in the world. So it's a great question. It can make sense, but it doesn't always make sense. It depends upon where the money's coming from. And this kind of segues in, Susie, into something. Your question might have been, you know, met pre-retirement. I'm still living my life. I'm still working.
Yes.
But I've got these obligations, this debt, and I've got this money. But especially we talk about this a lot when it comes to retirement income planning, right? When I need money, there's always a smart place to go get it. We call it the Wealth Enhancement Smart Money Strategy. And the smartest money is going to be a combination of what are the investment results, if I can sell stocks when they're at or near high and I have a lot of embedded gains, that's a good time to sell. Sometimes people push back a little bit and they say, well, gosh, Bruce, if I sell, I'm going to have to pay taxes. And I always say, well, yeah, but it's better to pay taxes because you made money than get a deduction because you lost money. Making money is good, and you're going to have to pay taxes if you make money. So it's a combination of tax efficiencies and investment results, but we always want clients to have options. We want multiple buckets of money. Some of it's tax deferred, some of it's taxable, some of it's tax advantaged, some of it's in the market, some of it's not. Some of it is in one of these safe, interest-bearing rainy day or emergency fund accounts, and maybe you want to use that account to pay off an onerous loan. That's okay to do that. So again, it depends upon the person. It depends upon your goals, objectives, your time horizon, your risk tolerance, a lot of different things, but it's certainly nice to have options. So rainy day account, most people don't have it. We highly recommend it. And then the second thing that most people should do is participate in your company retirement plan. And the reason I say this, there's a lot of reasons. Number one, it's easy to participate, right? The employer just withholds the money from your paycheck. You really don't have to do anything. You don't have to write out a check. You don't have to worry about it every month. It's just sort of on automatic pilot. And on every paycheck, a portion of your paycheck is going in to your retirement plan. Now, it used to always be, Susie, that when I talked about this, the retirement plan, whether it was a 401k or a 403b or a 457, it doesn't matter. They all kind of work the same way, that the contribution is like a traditional IRA, and you would get a deduction for the contribution, and then it would grow tax deferred until you withdraw the money, presumably, hopefully, at retirement. But now, most employers offer you a choice between a tax deductible plan or a traditional 401k or a traditional plan, or a Roth, where it's after-tax dollars. You don't get a deduction for the contribution, but you might be able to take withdrawals completely tax-free. So it's a trickier question. I get the question a lot, should I participate in the Roth 401k or the traditional? It's going to be up to each individual circumstance, but for most people, if you have the option, it's probably a combination of both. But today, I'm less concerned with whether it should be Roth or traditional and more concerned just with the idea of doing it. Because saving and investing, even if it seems like a small amount, if you look at it on a per-month basis, you do that consistently over time and you add earnings to it and it becomes a really big number. And I'll give you a really good example on that in a second. So there's a lot of things to like about these plans. It's easy to participate. You don't miss the money. I've said this many times on the show. Peg has talked about the same thing. Many of us, even if we think we're disciplined, if we had to physically do something every month to make that investment, if we had to write out a check or we had to do a transfer to the account, there would be some months where we would neglect to do it. Something came up that we bought that we really wanted and thought we had to have, and I'm going to skip my investment this month and I'll get back to it next month. We all, at certain times, might lack that discipline. Well, again, when it's on this automatic pilot and it's just withheld from your paycheck, you just learn to live on the paycheck you get, and you really typically aren't going to miss that money, and you're consistently putting money into something for the future. And then finally, most of these plans also have a matching contribution from your employer if you participate. So it's not uncommon where I might see a plan, for example, Susie, where they say, we'll contribute 50 cents on the dollar for the first 6% that you put into the plan. Well, 50 cents on the dollar, if I put in 6%, is another 3% that they put in, that they match. That's a 50% return on investment. I don't know any investment advisor, including wealth enhancement, that's going to make you 50%. So participating in your plan, at least to the minimum extent that you get the matching contribution, is smart for almost everybody. So
okay.
Again,
I have another question along those lines. Putting in the full max amount and still having debt, what do you call it, inefficient debt, should you manage the inefficient debt first and use your money that's coming out and not put it in your investment or lessen the amount that you put in, use that extra money to pay down that efficient debt?
Yeah, another great question. I love you. Okay, so if it's really onerous debt, if it's high interest, non-deductible debt, and it's really a burden, and right now you're putting the max or a lot into your company retirement plan, I would tell most people to pull back a little bit and contribute less to their plan. Again, I want you to still put in the minimum that you have to get the maximum match, But instead of going beyond that, maybe you take that excess capital and you apply that to the ugly or onerous debt service. Again, if it's a really high interest rate and it's really a burden, that probably makes more sense than putting more into the plan. But getting that matching contribution is probably your first priority. Anything over and above that might be gravy or icing on the cake if you've got other places where you need to put that money, like paying down, you know, a bad debt. And the other thing that I really want to emphasize is the idea of starting early. Now, some of our listeners, you maybe you're already close to retirement or you've already retired and that ship has sailed when I talk about starting early. But a lot of people listening, this is still going to apply to, and if it doesn't apply to you, it might apply to your children or your grandchildren. So in my last book, Real Wealth, I actually just took this example right out of the book. I told the story of Jack and Jill. Jack and Jill are twins. Jill's an overachiever. Jill, at age 21, starts to put $5,000 a year into a Roth IRA. She does it for 10 years, $5,000 a year for 10 years. After 10 years, Jill's so uber successful, she makes so much money that she can no longer fund a Roth IRA. There's income restrictions on a Roth that if you make too much money, you don't get to participate anymore. Well, Jack, who's kind of lagging behind, he starts to contribute $5,000 a year to a Roth IRA right when Jill stops. At age 31, Jack starts to put his $5,000 a year in, and he does it all the way until 65. So Jack, over the course of 30 years, contributes $175,000 to a Roth. Jill only contributes $50,000 because she does it for 10 years, then she can't do it anymore. But Jill starts 10 years sooner. They both earn a hypothetical 8% every year on their investment. Who do you think's got more money at age 65? And I probably kind of give it away just the way I set it up. But I think if you think about investing $175,000 versus 50, you might think Jack would have more. But Jill has got over $1.1 million. Jack's only got about $930,000. Jill has some $230,000 more than Jack just because she started sooner. So my message to people all the time is do what you can as soon as you can, even if it doesn't seem like a big amount. You do something consistently over a long period of time, and it ends up growing into being a big number. But consistency and starting as soon as you can, I think, are the keys here. And then I know, we're already down to a couple minutes left in the first segment. The other thing I really wanted to hit on is I talk about this a lot, and people have heard me say this on the show before, but it bears repeating. It's the idea that strategies are actually more important than the investments that we make. Now, there can be an exception to that. If you bought Microsoft, you know, in its infancy stages, you're going, oh, that's the greatest investment I ever made. But how many times did you try to do that and it didn't work? The stock or the investment didn't do well. And when I talk about strategies being more important than investments, what I really mean is in the world of investing, people can debate whether the fund family that starts with the letter A or the letter F or the letter V is the best. And I'm telling you, it really doesn't matter. If you pick an investment with a similar investment objective, the results and the returns are going to be very similar. But we can get dramatically different results with the strategies we use. I've been talking about Roth a lot already today. So Roth is not an investment. I still sometimes, Susie, get questions like, well, what kind of rate of return has Wealth Enhancement got on their Roth IRAs? Well, it depends. The Roth is a strategy. It's not an investment. What I put in that strategy could be stocks, could be bonds, could be real estate, could be funds, could be gold and silver and other precious metals. It could be commodities. It could be just an interest-bearing money market. I can put a lot of different things in there that are going to have a very different rate of return. But let's say I put something in there that makes 8% every year, like my Jack and Jill example. 8% tax-free is going to be very different than 8% that I have to pay taxes on every year. 8% taxable is going to net to less than 6%. That extra 2% that I get return on investment is not the investment, it's the strategy of putting it in a Roth IRA. The strategy is what really, you know, makes my investment sizzle. Another really quick example. I'm gonna talk about three different investors. Well, you know what? This one might take me a while. I think I'll either talk about this, Susie, in the second half, or if I don't get to it, that's okay. But the point I want to make is there's strategic ideas. Again, it starts with your core values. What are you trying to accomplish? That helps you set goals. And if we know what your goals are, we can devise an investment strategy and make investments that get you where you want to be with the least amount of risk possible. So investing, to me, I always look at it as an important part of financial planning, but it's a subset of comprehensive planning. And these strategies, this consistency, this common sense approach, not getting, you know, too shook up if things look really good or if things look really bad, but sticking to your plan, this common sense is going to lead to success more so than the investments that you pick or trying to read the headlines and figure out if you should be buying this, that, or something, whatever. That stuff, for the most part, isn't going to matter that much. So let's take our break, and if I have time, I'll get to one more example. But if we have enough questions, we'll just do questions. The example can wait.
That sounds good. 651-461-9226. That's the number you can call right now if you have a question. Maybe you're in a situation that begs an answer to your question. 651-461-9226. We already have a couple of text questions coming in about a parent asking if their child should buy a house. If they make a lot of money and they've got the money, buy a house. That's a big one. We'll get to some of your questions after this break on Your Money. And we are back for the second half of Your Money. Bruce Helmer flying solo today. Peg has got a well-deserved day off. And we're talking about common sense investing, the wealth enhancement way, going through a number of topics with Bruce, 651-461-9226. If you have a question about this or anything related to your money, Bruce, welcome back. If you want to recap, we do have a couple questions coming in on our text line.
Thank you, Susie Jones. Now, I think, you know, again, I don't want to rehash everything I did in the first half of the show. I worry, you know, when I do the show solo, I worry about not having enough. Turns out I have probably enough here for two shows.
Yeah.
Some of this I didn't get to, I'll save, maybe do it in another show. But there was a couple things I wanted to hit on really quick that are very timely. On Friday, we got the new inflation numbers, and inflation is currently running at about 3%. Which isn't great, but it's not as bad as a lot of analysts were predicting. That led to a really good day in the market on Friday, in the stock market on Friday. Most of the indexes closed at all-time highs. And then also for listeners that are on Social Security, the Social Security cost of living adjustment was also announced. So in 2026, your benefit's going to go up 2.8%. for the inflation or cost of living adjustment to Social Security. So those are big things that just happened late in the week that I thought were worthy of mentioning that are timely. But, yeah, Susie, let's let listeners drive the whole second half of the show.
Let's do it. Texter writes, good morning. My son earns about $100,000 a year. He has $50,000 already in his 401k and has $10,000 in an emergency fund. Wow. He's only 27. I would like him to buy a home, but he insists on renting. Would it be wise for him to take a loan from his 401k? I will be giving him some cash for the house deposit. Thank you.
So, great question, and I love all the detail because it really helps me get a clear picture. I think that, first of all, taking a loan from the 401k to buy the house, I don't like that idea at all. It's certainly a possibility, and if it was the only way that someone could afford a house and they really felt like they wanted or needed to have a house, I never say never, but that's not something I would really endorse or recommend in most situations. On the other hand, it sounds like this 27-year-old already with a big balance in a 401k and $10,000 sitting in the bank.
Right.
Fantastic. I just love it. My heart happy to hear that.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know, and it sounds like mom and dad or whoever wrote the text is also willing to help. So there's buying a house to me is partly an economic decision from this standpoint. If you look at your total cost of the mortgage to buy a home, now again, just saying buying a house is very broad, very vague. How much house are you going to buy, and what is your payment going to be? So buying a house that's affordable where your mortgage payment might not be significantly higher, or in some cases I've even seen it where it's lower than your monthly rent, so it's very affordable, might make economic sense. The challenge usually is coming up with the down money, because normally to get a good mortgage or get good terms and conditions on a loan, you need to put a certain percentage down, let's say 10% down. So if I'm going to buy a $300,000 house, I need $30,000. For most young people, that's the challenge. But I also don't see this only as an economic decision. I see it as a lifestyle decision. So I know young people, and I think, frankly, of my son, he had the economic wherewithal to buy a home long before he actually did. He since has. But he resisted that at first, because even though he was renting and he understood the concept that rent money was going down the drain, never coming back to him, not building equity like a mortgage does and owner of something that you have ownership of, he liked his lifestyle. He liked where he lived from a location standpoint and nightlife and close walking distance to certain things. So he rented because it was a lifestyle choice of where he wanted to live and his circumstances at the time. He ultimately did buy a house, but I think buying a house is more of a lifestyle choice than an economic choice. But economically, if you can afford the down payment, it certainly makes sense from the standpoint that even though you're financing or paying interest, borrowing money, you're doing so on an appreciating asset. Generally speaking, homes and real estate values will go up over time. It's very, very different than, say, buying a car, where it's worth less the second you drive it off the lot and there's depreciation immediately. So I like the idea of buying a home. Economically, it can, and most of the time, probably does make sense. But I really think it comes back to the texture. It comes back to your son's lifestyle. Do they really want a home? And if he's resistant and doesn't want to do it right now, he's probably not emotionally ready. He probably likes where he's at right now and really doesn't want it. And I think that has to be the top consideration in making that decision.
Yeah, it's interesting when you try to tell your kids what to do. I'm just saying, I have a similar daughter than that 27-year-old, and I'm like, come on, buy a house. She's like, leave me alone. Okay, let's see. I have a family member with a very strong portfolio. After losing her husband, she sold their home to take advantage of the capital gains exemption. She is now sitting on quite a bit of cash and has been renting for a long time. Oh, we have a theme here. Very rarely at home and struggling with the question, continue to rent or buy a house. She's 70 years old and still working, rarely home. What would your advice be? This is so, I'm interested in this because, again, if you're never home, if your home is not like the most special place in the world, like you know what I mean? Some people aren't that connected to their home, right, Bruce?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I got to tell you, Susie, that I've actually had kind of a change of thought on this. I used to always be against renting with the idea, going back to the previous question, that money's going down the drain. It's not coming back to you. You're not building any owner's equity or any you're not going to own something at the end of the day. The money's just gone. But I've really changed my thinking in some situations, and this second question might be a good example. When you're older, when you're retired or near retirement, or in this case, lost her spouse and she's 70, you could make the argument that cash on hand is more valuable than owning real estate. In other words, the proceeds from the sale of that house, she could take that money and go buy another property, but then to some degree she's lost access to that cash. So even though she's renting, and that money's kind of going out the door and never coming back, she's got a big pile of money from the sale of the last home that might be very valuable to her at this point in her life for all the other things. And if she doesn't have, now it says she's hardly ever home. Is that because she doesn't really like being home? Or and maybe she would stay at home more if she had a home that she liked? Or is it just a lifestyle choice that she's not going to be home much anyway, even if she had a nice house? So why bother? So, and I've seen this a lot in recent years, and I've got clients that are renting on purpose, and I've come around to their way of thinking that they like having all this money for you know, in the bank or with me invested or a combination of both. But where they're renting, oftentimes they're in complexes where there might it might be for senior living, and they've made a lot of friends, and there's a lifestyle, and there's a lot of events within the where they live and planned activities, and they just really enjoy the lifestyle. And in that case, I don't mind renting. I've changed my thinking on that in certain situations. Not always, but in certain situations, I can get on board the idea of renting as opposed to buying and owning a home.
All right, 651-461-9226, 651-461-9226, a texter. A listener called in, didn't want to go on the air, but asked this question. What is better? I am getting ready to retire, and I want to know how to best proceed with my 401k with a financial advisor. Do I leave it as a 401k, or do I change it into an IRA before giving it to an advisor?
Again, great question. So there's basically, when you retire, when you separate service, there's basically four possible choices. Let's say if you're not retiring, but you're going on to another job, there's four options. If you're retiring, you're only down to three. You can either just leave it right where it is, okay? You don't need to do anything with your company retirement plan if you retire or if you leave to go to another company. You don't have to do anything. You can just leave it there. And in my experience, Susie, that's what a lot of people end up doing. And I think it's because, you know, it's sort of the course of least resistance. They don't have to make any decisions or do anything if they just leave it there. So that's the easy road. So that's what they do. If it's somebody that's actually not retiring but going to a different job, they might have the option of rolling for the 401k or the retirement plan from job A, the first job, into job B, the new job where they're going. They can move the plan into their new employer's plan sometimes. That's the second option. That option is not available if you're retiring, obviously. So then the third option would be to just cash it out, take a withdrawal, take the money, and I'm going to use it for lifestyle. Now, obviously, there's going to be a big tax liability if you do that. So most people don't want to do that all in 1 year. They might do it over a period of time and use it kind of as an income stream over time, as retirement income to replace their paycheck if they're retired. And then the fourth option is what the texter is asking about. Can I convert my 401k to an IRA? So when we meet with people that are confronted with this decision, we make sure that we point out that these are the four options that are available to them. Sometimes there is an advantage in leaving the company retirement plan, the 401k or whatever it is, with the old company, even though it's a dormant plan and you don't work there anymore. One example might be if you're not yet 59 and a half, but you're 55 or older, there might be some accessibility or some flexibility to get withdrawals from this plan in a more advantageous way than if you converted it to an IRA, where you're very restricted until you reach the age of 59 and a half. The other thing to look at is the cost. So if I'm going to move from my company plan to an individual retirement account, what are the costs in the company plan versus the cost in the IRA? And usually, you're going to have a higher cost in the IRA because you're going to go invest that with somebody like me, like a wealth enhancement or some company like ours, and there's going to be some sort of a management fee that might be higher than what you have on the 401k. But to those people, I would also say cost is something that you need to consider and be aware of, but it's not the only thing to base the decision on. Sometimes a little extra cost might lead to much higher gross returns and still give the individual a higher net. So one of the reasons this might be true is any company plan, even a really, really good one, is going to be limited in terms of the investment choices within the plan as compared to the number of investment choices outside of the plan. Most retirement plans, 401ks, you might have, you know, a dozen, 15, 20, 30, maybe even 50 options. But outside the plan, you've got literally thousands of options. There's individual stocks and bonds. There's funds. There's precious metals. There's commodities. The sheer volume of choices outside of the plan as compared to inside might enable the investor to get higher returns and might enable them to reduce their risk or create a portfolio that's geared towards income if they want income at retirement to replace their paycheck. Sometimes the choices within a company plan don't give you good options for reducing risk or providing income. So, number one, the sheer number of options available if you convert to an IRA from a 401k. The second one, and Peg and I have talked about this a lot on the show before, is the control issue. So the company 401k, it might be your money, but it's their plan. And they can do things to their plan that you might not like, that might not be in your best interest. Now, to give them that kind of control over your money if you work there, that's a different kettle of fish. You're working there. But if you don't work there anymore, why would you give a corporate entity control over your money? If you convert or roll it over into an individual retirement account, an IRA, there's nobody between you and your money. The IRA is individual. It's an individual account. It's yours. You control it. Nobody can tell you what you can and can't do with that money. So the two big reasons to consider rolling over would be complete control and more investment options. I know some cynical people might say, well, the financial advisor, Helmer or Wealth Enhancement, they want you to do an IRA because they want you to invest with them so they get paid. Look, the elephant in the room, full disclosure. Yes, we do. And I acknowledge that when I explain to people, here are your options, here's everything you need to know and consider to make a fully informed decision. But Susie, I think for most people, when they separate service, when they retire, they're going to be better off moving that to an individual retirement account. And then finally, and this is important, and I know I'm giving a long answer, it's important that you do this right and you don't try to do this on your own. If you do it wrong, if you try to do it alone and you just say, I'm going to transfer to an IRA, there's mandatory withholdings that the custodian of that 401k or that corporate plan, they're going to withhold 20% of your money. That's the way the law works. But if you do it correctly, we do what's called a custodian-to-custodian transfer, then there's nothing withheld. And that means the money doesn't actually physically come to you. You don't get a check. It lands in your new investment account, your new IRA that you set up, and you get notification or confirmation that the money has transferred, and then there's no taxes withheld. I've seen situations before where people try to do this on their own, and they're shocked that they get 20% less than they thought they were going to get because they didn't do it right. So it's a great question. It's a fair question. A lot of things to consider, but I would say for the majority of people, you're going to be better off converting that to an IRA, and you're going to be better off getting a professional to help you do it and make sure you do it right and invest it right.
All right. 651-461-9226. A couple people chimed in on the ups, pros and cons of buying or renting. Someone said, homes are a lot of work. I don't want to keep up the yard, the maintenance, yada, yada. So that was
that's
good.
That's a great point.
Yeah, I thought so too. You know,
yeah, I should have thought of that. And that's
no, it's fine. Yeah, I was just like, that's really a good idea.
Yep.
Good point, yep. I should say. Let me get to this next question. I'm getting to reach full retirement age next year, and I'm considering starting Social Security and continuing to work. Will my Social Security benefit increase with continuing to work beyond the yearly amount that I would get?
Yep, really good question. So full retirement age now for most people is probably going to be 67, or it might be 66 years and some months, depending upon what year you were born. I'm not going to run through that right now because it's not the heart of what they're really asking. The heart of what they're asking is, I'm drawing my benefit, but I'm still working. So your benefit is based on your 35 best years of work history. So if you're making more money now than you were, you know, 35 or 40 years ago, which is probably the case, it's actually going to enhance your benefit going forward, and in addition to the cost of living adjustments, because they recalculate it every year. So it's not uncommon that we see people that are still working and still drawing Social Security, and it actually can be a good thing. It's not a negative. There's no detrimental impact, unless, and this is the one you got to be careful of, I've seen people before that are still working, but they haven't yet reached full retirement age. You can start to take Social Security as early as age 62, But again, your full retirement age is either going to be 67 or 66 years and some months. And if you start before you hit that full retirement age, then there can be a negative impact on your benefit if you make over a certain dollar amount. I can't remember where they set that benchmark now, and it changes a little bit every year. So you really have to be careful. If you're still working and you want to draw Social Security, if you've hit full retirement age, that's fine. No problem. Doesn't matter how much money you make. There isn't going to be a negative impact. But if you haven't yet gotten to full retirement age, I would tell anybody and everybody, don't start to draw your Social Security yet then. Wait until you get to that full retirement age.
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, when taking withdrawals from my 401k in retirement, how is the tax rate considered? This is a really good question, too. So you're retired. When you take your money out of 401k, that affects your, right? That's taxed, right?
Yep.
How do you figure?
So anything you take out of a traditional IRA, traditional 401k, it's taxed as ordinary income. Ordinary income tax rates right now, and this is pretty common, a lot of people, married couple filing jointly, you might be in, let's say, a 12% federal tax bracket. If you make adjusted gross income of less than $96,950, you're in a 12% bracket. So assume 12% for federal, and then it, depending upon the state you live in, there's also going to be state income taxes on that. Sometimes we get, Susie, what's called bracket creep, where the withdrawal from the tax-deferred account moves you into another bracket. So let's say that the withdrawal from your IRA or 401k puts you to $100,000. Now you went over that $96,950, and you go, oh, my God, now I got to pay 22%.
Mm-hmm.
It's a progressive tax rate. That extra 10% going from 12 to 22 is only on that $3,050 over and above the benchmark. It doesn't go back to dollar one. So when we do retirement income planning, we try to be tax efficient and we try to prevent bracket creep. But if it does happen, but you just barely creep into the next bracket, it really doesn't hurt you that much. And sometimes it's just unavoidable. There's nothing you can do.
Okay. This person says, I was born in 1965. How long do I work until full retirement? You kind of just touched on that. What full retirement?
We have a short
amount of time.
Yep, it's going to be age 67. If you were born 1960 or later,
okay,
your full retirement age for Social Security is 67.
Oh, good show, Bruce. If people still have questions, they can always call Wealth Enhancement at 1-888-6-ADVICE or ask those questions at yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. 1-888-6-ADVICE or yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Bruce, have a wonderful day. It's going to be glorious outside, and we hope Peg's back next week fully rested. All right, have a good one. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We're back after this.